From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. High school students in North Carolina will soon learn much more about personal financial literacy. You'll learn why that pleases members of the state education board. Lawmakers want to help school systems fill some vacant teaching jobs. They'll do it by recruiting recently retired teachers back to the classroom. You'll hear details. Some legislators continue to push for reform of a medical regulation called the Certificate of Need, or CON. You'll hear how that certificate can block medical innovation. Plus, we'll hear the latest numbers linked to homeschooling and private schools in North Carolina. There's continued growth. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
The results are in North Carolina's special GOP primary election in North Carolina's 3rd Congressional District. Now, this sets up a four-way race in September's general election to fill the seat left open by the death of longtime Congressman Walter Jones. Plus, it's just one of two special September congressional elections here in North Carolina. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. He's been following both of these races very closely. Joins us now. Rick, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Don.
So in the third, in the GOP primary, we have a winner. Who is it?
Right. It's Dr. Greg Murphy, who is a state representative from Pitt County, from Greenville. And he defeated another physician, pediatrician Joan Perry, who's from Kinston. They were the two candidates who survived a 17-candidate primary election, which was held a couple months ago. And now Greg Murphy won pretty easily. It was a 60-40 race, and will now go on to face three candidates. Alan Thomas, the Democrat, former mayor of Greenville, Libertarian primary winner Tim Harris, who was a Libertarian Party primary, and the Constitution Party's candidate Greg Holt.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the endorsements in this GOP primary, because they were huge. You had big-time national names that were weighing in on this race. So who was supporting whom?
Well, the big one for Greg Murphy was the Freedom Caucus and U.S. Representative Mark Meadows of the 11th District, who's the chairman of the House Freedom Caucus. That provided a lot of the emphasis and the oomph for Greg Murphy's campaign. Joan Perry was endorsed by a lot of people. Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, Sarah Palin, the former vice presidential nominee, every Republican female member of the House, several female U.S. senators, including Joni Ernst, who was a rumored vice presidential choice for Donald Trump back in 2016. And FreedomWorks, the grassroots conservative organization, also endorsed Joan Perry. And she got a lot of outside money. She may have actually outspent Greg Murphy in the race, even though the candidate's personal campaign accounts, Greg Murphy was about $200,000 ahead. But Joan Perry may have actually spent close to $500,000 to $1 million more people supporting her in this
race.
That
is so fascinating about these endorsements, Rick. Was there any sort of policy distinction between these two candidates? Was one, for example, more of a free marketer versus the other?
Well, both of them emphasized the fact that they were going to be the person who was going to most closely hew to the Donald Trump line. That was issue number one as far as winning over grassroots support. But the thing that did divide them was that Greg Murphy has been a co-sponsor and, until a few days ago, a very advocate supporter of legislation over the past two sessions that would come very, very close to expanding Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act to people who currently don't qualify for it, mainly able-bodied single males who are working and earn too much money to qualify for Medicaid. He removed his sponsorship from this bill, even though he was a very vocal advocate of it, both in the 2017 session and in the current session. It was called Carolina Cares then. It's called North Carolina Healthcare for Working Families. And it's actually, as we're recording this segment, still a live issue in the state house. Joan Perry, Dr. Perry said was basically, this is Medicaid expansion. This is a bad deal. This is going to throw hundreds of thousands of more North Carolinians on the dole. And it's going to cost, it's going to blow up the budget, cost taxpayers lots of money, and it's a bad thing.
So now that Greg Murphy has prevailed in this primary race, he is going to go forward to this September general election. You mentioned that this is a four-person race. There is a Libertarian candidate in the race. There is, I believe, a Constitution Party candidate. What does that mean for Republican voters? Typically, the Republican electorate might choose one of those three people versus the Democrat.
Well, in this case, the district is rated safe Republican by all the major political ratings organizations. Now, part of that is because of Walter Jones and because he ran unopposed in last November. The registration and voting pattern suggests it's a safe Republican district, but it's hard to say. Alan Thomas was mayor of Greenville. He's somebody who's not going to have any problem raising money. He was the executive director or head of the Global Trans Park for a while. So he's somebody who's going to have a lot of knowledge and probably a lot of support in the local area. The other two candidates may divert some votes from Greg Murphy. We'll see. I mean, as I say, this Medicaid expansion controversy is probably not going to go away.
Do we have any indication, Rick, that national Democrats are paying as close attention to this race in the 3rd District as we know they are in the special 9th Congressional District race that is a matchup between Democrat Dan McCready and Republican Dan Bishop?
I haven't seen it yet. Now, part of it may just be they're going to wait to see who won, because the perception largely was that Greg Murphy, having been elected to the state legislature for a couple of terms, also being someone who is, I believe, the chairman of the board of the Vidant Medical Center. And I mean, he's very closely tied to the Brody Medical School at East Carolina. He's somebody who's got a lot of local recognition. And so the thought was, between the help he was going to get from national Republicans and the like, that he was going to be the easier candidate to prevail in the fall, in the September election, than Dr. Perry, whose support largely was from the outside grassroots, and then, of course, from Republicans who were just trying to get more women elected to Congress, basically.
This is going to be a fascinating race for sure in this September special election there. Also, over in the 9th Congressional District, we also will have that race on the ballot in September. As I mentioned, Democrat McCready versus Republican Bishop. They're having this election because of, well, I guess the Reader's Digest version would be ballot shenanigans in the original race in the 9th District. What do we know? National Democrats still paying lots and lots of attention, perhaps money, into this race for McCready?
Yeah, they are. They are pouring money and attention into the race. From what we're seeing from the local reporters in Charlotte, there's actual interest in this race, which is very unusual for special elections, especially off-year elections. And this is going to be one that actually may have a reasonable turnout. Democrats thought they had this thing won outright back in November, after all the shenanigans were brought to light. McCready quite wisely continued raising money throughout the controversy and is going to probably have a financial advantage over Dan Bishop, who's still serving in the state Senate. And so the thing that's going to have to happen now to make this all work is that the get out the vote efforts are going to be essential. And the question is basically, is Dan McCready, who's Mecklenburg County representative, is he going to be able to sway, get the Union County vote, which he needs, and then the vote from the eastern districts, which are more conservative than the vote that Dan McCready would get from Mecklenburg County.
So, Rick, what about potential involvement of President Trump into either one of these races, anticipating that he will come in and campaign either for Greg Murphy in the 3rd or Dan Bishop in the 9th?
I would be surprised if he didn't. It wouldn't be surprising also to see Lara Trump, his daughter-in-law, come especially in the 3rd, since she's sort of from the area down there toward the coast. And so I think we'll see some active support from the president, because these are votes he's going to need.
And one has to wonder as well if some of those higher profile Democratic presidential candidates, if they're coming into North Carolina, if they might hook up with the Democrats in those races as well.
Two for the price of one.
Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Carolina Journal has been following both of these congressional races very closely. Rick Henderson, thank you very much.
Thank you, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are, and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly. But our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina high school students will see a new emphasis in the future on economics and personal financial literacy. The state law sets up a new mandatory course on that topic. The State Board of Education recently discussed the issue. Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest explained.
The intent of the financial literacy and economics legislation is to create a four-credit class for high school. I mean, we've had financial literacy and economics in high school before, but not for credit. It's an elective course, and obviously students are competing for GPAs to get into college, and so most students by far do not take this course. Obviously, it goes without saying, but we have $22 trillion in debt in this nation. Our largest form of personal debt is student loan debt at $1.6 trillion and growing every single day. We have over $130 trillion of unfunded liabilities or promises made to people that we have no funds in the bank to pay for a long-term future. And so I think, you know, what we have is a lot of students, not to their fault at all, graduating high school that don't have a firm concept of economics and financial literacy. And I think that it is, you know, there's overwhelming support in the community. People see this. They see the need for this. Even a lot of the people that have been taking the training and for these courses in other states like Virginia, who this legislation is modeled after, even the teachers come away from that training going, wow, I wish I would have known this in high school. How come we didn't know this already? And so I think it's good across the board, not just for our students, but for our adults as well, and even for our families, because I think the students take this back into their homes as well and can you know, teach their parents some of these concepts. A lot of people would say, well, you know, that's a lot of work to have a four-credit class for balancing your checkbook. And that's not about balancing your checkbook. That would be one aspect of it. But there's a whole slew of things this is about.
Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest wanted to be certain his state board colleagues learned the facts about the new requirement.
There's been a lot of misinformation related to what's actually in the bill itself and how we go about doing that. One of the big pieces of controversy has been about adding things onto the teacher's plate. I can say that there's probably no bigger proponent than me than of saying we don't need to add anything additional onto the teacher's workload for sure. But at the same time, we've been working, our staff and legislative staff has been working with DPI and others to work this into the rework of social studies standards that was being done anyway. We were at that point in time, that five-year period, where we were going to be reworking social studies, so working this into that. So the intent is to make sure that we're not adding anything additional onto the plates of these teachers, and also to note that it's not just social studies teachers who can teach this, that any teacher can go and get this training over the summer, get their $500 stipend for taking this training, and then go back and be able to teach financial literacy. So we're kind of spreading that love around as well to other teachers.
Jamie Falconberry in the Lieutenant Governor's office offered more information about the standards tied to the new course.
The standards that you have are the economic standards. There's also financial literacy standards that are similar to what we've already been teaching in our schools, except except they're a little bit more detailed. But what we find is when we talk to people with a lot of stakeholders, they say, well, why don't we just keep this as a half course credit or just push this in with something else? It's impossible to do when you include the economic standards as well. And,
right.
And just take some time, and it may take you 5 minutes just to read through them, but you'll see how much more in depth they go.
Very good.
And the knowledge that the students will learn from this. And what we've seen in other states that have implemented this, their teachers actually benefit a lot from understanding the curriculum that's involved with that.
I'm impressed.
That positive reaction came from State Education Board member Olivia Oxendine. Colleague James Ford had a question about the standards.
Who's the entity that's creating both this and the financial literacy standards?
Sure. So we're using what it's called the Council of Economic for Education. It's a national organization that is... a lot of accreditation across the nation on educating students as well as adults on financial literacy and economics. And we're using their best practices that have been used in other states. What we're using is specific standards too. The ones from that were done after the financial crisis in 2009 for financial literacy, and then their economic standards that they released in 2013. And we're purposely using those specific standards because they've already been benchmarked and used throughout the nation. But we also don't want to get into a situation before where we just say we're going to accept the Council of Economic Standards, right, and then get into the Common Core situation again where an entity owns the standards, and we don't want to say we're using the most current version, because then we lose control over those standards. So if the Council for Economic Education at any time changes their standards, we will be using the ones that we've already approved and that we can move around.
North Carolina will approve their own standards.
Yes.
Right?
Ford had another question about economic standards.
The financial literacy piece I get. Having taught civics and economics, I know a lot of these concepts are things we teach in our course, right? So mm-hmm. I'm just like wondering, what was the impetus of the calculus behind creating a separate sort of course to focus in on just the macroeconomic pieces of that?
There are some schools that are doing this great, so I'm not speaking for all, but for a lot of sections, the teachers didn't either feel comfortable teaching it, or they did not have the background to teach it. Therefore, they glanced over it, or they didn't dive as deep as they should have into these standards. And with the professional development that they're going to be going through either over the summer, again, that $500 stipend, or if there's opportunities during the school year for them to receive this professional development, they'll be better prepared to deliver in depth all these standards and cover them.
Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest chimed in with information about course credit.
Related to the credit for the course as well, it's really important to make sure all students are taking this. And this isn't, some people have said, well, we're rushing this through, and it doesn't start until 2020 with the freshman class, the 2020 freshman class. So that is the point where that credit for high school, mandatory credit for high school, will come into effect. So it'll be the 2023-24 graduating class then that would fall under that provision.
Board member Amy White likes the new focus on economics and personal financial literacy.
During my teaching career, I had the blessing to teach economics, legal, and political systems. So I cannot tell you how important I feel like this curriculum is for our state. In my present job, I work with at-risk adults who frequently have more month than they have money. And the missing piece is a fundamental misunderstanding about debt, finance, saving, investment, and a simple budget. What comes in must equal what goes out, or else you're in trouble. And so now, working on the back end, I teach financial literacy to adults most Wednesday nights starting in January, and understanding that critical piece. If we could help folks understand even as early as high school, because I keep showing my iPhone, but a non-cash society, a society that is dependent on exchange through, I hate to say, Apple Pay or whatever platform, has created a misunderstanding about cost of living, about a contradiction between needs versus wants. So I cannot applaud us enough about putting this back into our standards and providing an opportunity for all students across the state of North Carolina. Most of us are blessed with good training, but we have folks across this state whose families come from poverty and the structure is not there, and giving that in a high school setting to all students is important.
You've been listening to highlights from the State Board of Education's recent discussion of a new law. It requires future high school students to take a course on economics and personal financial literacy. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some North Carolina lawmakers want to find good teachers for high-need public schools. They're turning to retired teachers for help. Republican State Senator Rick Horner explains.
We all acknowledge we have a serious teacher shortage in many of our schools. Our teachers retire sometimes as young as age 52 and 3 and find employment in private industry at banks or even private schools, but they can't come to work for us. And so what this bill does, it tries to address that problem. It'll have, if it's passed, it'll have an immediate impact. A lot of things we do here, it takes 2 or 3 years. We do a study, and we don't know if it really works. You're going to see next year how this will impact our schools. Your superintendents will be able to replace long-term subs with high-quality teachers, some of the best that we've produced. And hopefully those teachers get financially rewarded pretty well, too.
How would the plan affect retired teachers?
It allows them to come back to work at what we define as a high-need school. It's a Title I school or school that scored a D or F on the grading system that we currently use in the prior year. The salary for that teacher will be a Schedule I salary if it's at a normal, if she's teaching a normal course, 30,000. If it's a STEM or a special ed, I believe it is a two level, 35,000. They'll also be entitled to the local supplement, which could be quite substantial for these folks.
The proposal gives flexibility to local school superintendents.
The superintendents aren't forced to take them, and they get to pick who they want. As you know, some teachers need to retire. But some we really want back, and we want to have those superintendents have flexibility to pick those.
How might this plan affect the salary of a retired North Carolina teacher?
If you have any master's or National Board Certified income, you're just a regular teacher, but you did teach a STEM course, you retire earning about $56,000 your last year, and your retirement benefit would be around $30,500. You'd come back in and get $40,000. For this program. So your combined return number will be $70,500-something.
Republican Representative Jeff Elmore supported Horner's plan.
We've looked at that and the need, especially for our rural areas, in our retention issues and trying to keep people in the classroom. We find in a lot of the rural areas, it's the older worker base that we need to attract and try to hold on to.
You've been listening to legislative debate about a plan to attract more high-quality teachers to high-need schools in North Carolina. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some North Carolina lawmakers want to scrap the Certificate of Need, or CON. That's the state government permission slip a healthcare provider must collect in order to build a new facility, add hospital beds, or add a major piece of medical equipment. Lawmakers haven't been able to win support for a full-scale repeal, but Republican State Senator Joyce Krawczyk recently touted a bill to chip away at some CON regulations.
This bill removes the psychiatric hospitals, chemical dependency treatment facilities, certain continuing care facilities, and those are facilities that already have contracts with folks for their lodging. This allows those facilities to take care of those patients, of those residents in their home. That's the only ones that are affected by this are the continuing care communities. The bill increases monetary thresholds for diagnostic centers, for major medical equipment, for health facilities. Those adjustments have not been made since 1993. So this is just medical inflation that we are increasing the thresholds. Facilities that have a CON already, this will just require that they report the number of procedure rooms. Currently, only the ORs are reported. This just requires so we'll have an accurate description of how many there actually are. It allows single orthopedic surgical centers to become multi-specialty centers.
As with every other attempt to eliminate CON restrictions, this proposal generated pushback. In this case, those who control provision of kidney dialysis in North Carolina are fighting the bill. John Bodie lobbies for North Carolina radiologists and for Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center, which operates 20 dialysis centers. He offered lawmakers a cautionary tale.
In 2014, the state of Georgia took kidney dialysis out of CON. And when that happened, the dialysis facilities moved away from their rural areas. Currently, dialysis facilities in Georgia number 370. They serve 60% of their counties. They serve 60% of their counties. In North Carolina, where we have CON, we have 230 facilities. In North Carolina, we serve 90% of our counties.
Democratic Senator Floyd McKissick responded to the lobbyist's remarks.
It does give me great concern. We certainly don't want to forsake those people living in rural areas. They're already challenged enough with their health care problems. I know my mother underwent dialysis, and she did it at home for a while. She lived in a rural area 60 miles away from the Raleigh-Durham area. My mom passed away back in 05, but I became uniquely aware of the challenges of those who are facing dialysis by understanding what the difference was between the in-home peritoneal treatment and what it is like in a center. And for those in rural areas, the last thing we need them to do is have to pay for drivers, which my mom would have to do, our taxis, to go 50, 60 miles to get treatment. It's crazy. She ultimately had to relocate because of that challenge. But we don't need to do anything to put these people in rural areas, more isolated areas, at risk.
Republican Senator Joyce Krawczyk offered a response. She placed North Carolina and Georgia in a larger context.
Only 12 states in this country have certificate of need laws for kidney dialysis centers. So they're making it work. I know Mr. Bodie specifically spoke about Georgia, but he didn't speak about all the others. We are one of only 12 that require it. We are the fourth most regulated state on certificate of need. The federal government abolished it back in the 80s because they realized it didn't do what they had intended for it to do. And other states have responded by repealing it, or at least repealing portions of it. North Carolina has done nothing. It is time for us to get in line with the rest of the country to improve access to care.
Republican Senator Ralph Hise is a longtime advocate of certificate of need reform. He responded to criticism of the latest proposal.
Locking up competition and prohibiting other people from getting into the facility doesn't necessarily mean that dialysis centers are going to pop up on every corner store. The market will regulate those, but it does mean that those who are in a hospital, for an example, may not have to be loaded into an ambulance every day from the hospital and taken to a dialysis center in order to receive a treatment, then put back on the ambulance and taken back to the hospital. Happens every day in the districts I'm in, even when a dialysis center is, you know, 400 or 500 yards away from the hospital, because that facility couldn't offer it while it has greater medical expertise than maybe even the centers themselves. I think this bill as a whole, this is the very vanilla version of CON. I've said that this is basically the non-controversial, but I understand. Anytime you've got a market that is protected by state law, you're going to fight to keep that market protected. But I think most of us believe, as in every other market, that competition is what meets the needs of individuals. Allowing individuals to expand service means that we're not settling for 90% coverage.
While the kidney dialysis lobbyist panned the proposal, others supported the measure. Connie Wilson spoke in favor of certificate of need reform.
It's extremely important to the delivery of health care in North Carolina. As Senator Krawczyk has mentioned, we're the fourth most restrictive state in the country. We have 25 services that are regulated by CON. And this is starting the process of saying, hey, we need to look at the cost of health care and the access to health care. A lot of it is between, you know, negotiating with health insurance companies and providers. But this gets down to the basics, which is where people can get services and can they get quality services at lower cost. Just want to clarify that CON has nothing to do with quality of care. It's only the ability to compete. The Mercatus has done a study that shows that where CON is, quality of care in some instances is lower and cost is higher. So this is something for you guys to try. It's incremental.
Lou Ann Perriman represents Leading Age North Carolina Continuing Care Retirement Communities. She also supports reform.
We're not only regulated by the Department of Insurance, but also by the Department of Health Services regulation over at DHHS. So we're highly regulated, and we are an insurance product. And we have senior citizens that sign contracts with us, and we are then bound to take care of them from independent living through skilled nursing as needed. We even have memory care facilities on a lot of our communities. What this bill would allow us to do is to provide home health care services for our members under contract living in the community, not outside the community, living with lodging on the community. And when the state medical facilities plan did their projections for 2020, they estimated that 220,000 North Carolinians would need this service in 2020. And what we're talking about in our communities amounts to 0.2% of that group. So ours is a very, very small piece. It's all part of our mission to provide continuing care for our members living on campus, and we urge your support.
Certificate of Need reform requires support from the state Senate and House to become law. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Most school-age kids in North Carolina attend a traditional public school. But at the same time, more and more parents are now choosing other environments for their kids to learn in. Things like public charter schools, virtual school, private school, and increasingly, homeschool as well. Dr. Terry Stoops is following the trends and has new data to share with us. He is Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
The new data that you posted in the Locker Room blog, which folks can find by going to johnlocke.org, really, really surprised me because we are seeing a boom in homeschooling in our state. Tell us about that.
Well, according to the figures released by the North Carolina Division of Nonpublic Education, homeschool enrollment reached around 142,000 students during the 2018-2019 school year. This is up around 33% over the last 5 years and, of course, continues to increase by between 3 and 5% every year, depending on what year to year change you look at. So, predictions that homeschooling and homeschool rates of enrollment would decrease have really been overstated. And I think a lot of people thought that at this point we would see something of a downturn in the number of homeschoolers, or at least a decrease in the pace of the number of people that are homeschooling. But that doesn't seem to be the case.
It's a huge responsibility, of course, for a parent to take on the education of a child. Do you have any sense of what the trends are behind the growth?
Well, I think that the internet has a big part to play here. Getting curriculum materials is easier than ever. and there are more opportunities to get curriculum materials from companies that are catering to homeschool families. So you can really choose down to the finest detail how you teach your kids.
So you don't actually have to be a content expert to do this. You have up-to-date materials that can help you do this.
That's exactly right. And not only that, you have so many opportunities to look at videos on the internet. There's virtual schooling that some homeschool families take advantage of. So there are so many resources out there. It really takes the difficulty and the worries that a lot of parents have about homeschooling away. And that's particularly true when you're talking about homeschooling high school kids, when you start getting into advanced math and science. There's a lot of homeschool families that worry that those might be a little difficult to teach. But the internet makes it much, much easier to do.
Are we seeing any demographic trends in kids who are homeschooled, or any regional trends? Is it a rural trend? Is it growing in the urban areas?
All 100 counties in North Carolina have homeschool students, and it's growing pretty much in every area of the state. Rural communities are seeing some substantial growth in homeschooling. So we're seeing pretty good growth throughout North Carolina. You know, there was a time where it was really centered around North Carolina's urban and suburban corridors. But now it's the case that some of our urban communities are certainly getting into homeschooling at rates much greater than they have in the past. So we could see growth in counties that certainly didn't have homeschooling. If you look at the range of enrollment across the state for homeschools, they range from around 42 kids in Tyrrell County to 13,000 in Wake County. So that's the kind of range in homeschooling populations we have in North Carolina. And Wake County, by the way, has the largest population of homeschool students in the state.
In fact, this pool of homeschooled kids is so large that wouldn't it even rival several of the biggest districts in the state?
Yeah, absolutely. The homeschool population would be the third largest school district in the state. And it's getting really close to the Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools. I think probably in a year or two, it'll be the second largest, quote-unquote, school district in the state if we were to consider it a school district on its own. It'll take a while to catch up to Wake County. But I think that in time, it will certainly be there. And it's also worth mentioning that homeschooling is also the second most popular way of educating kids in North Carolina, second only to school districts. So when you look at all the choices that parents have, homeschooling outpaces charter schools and private school enrollment and is now the second largest group of education or educators in North Carolina.
So while the homeschooling population is surging just year after year after year, interesting trend also when it comes to North Carolina's private schools, a little bit of growth, but not huge.
Not huge growth, and there were wild predictions that the implementation of North Carolina's voucher and education savings accounts program would lead to incredible increases in the number of students going to private schools, but that's just not the case. Less than a 1% growth in year-to-year enrollment in private schools. We're looking at around 800 students, 800 additional students attending private schools in the 2018-2019 school year compared to the year before. That's not huge growth at all. And it was only a few years ago that we had a recession that really took a bite out of private school enrollment. They started to recover, but really there has been no huge flood of private school students attending private schools that would make any substantial increases in the total population of private school students in North Carolina.
Terry, what about public charter schools? We know that among the education bureaucracy, there tends to be some vocal opposition to charter schools, even though they are public schools. But they seem to have gotten the hackles up of some of those folks who are operating in the traditional public school system. Are charters continuing to grow as well?
They are. In fact, they're the third largest group of educators in North Carolina, with roughly about 105,000 students attending public charter schools, and 102,000, by the way, attending private schools in North Carolina. It has absolutely been the subject of a lot of consternation among those that are in public schools, mostly because they don't want to see the money follow the kid. When you have private school students and homeschool students, the tax dollars still flow to the districts, but they're not responsible for educating that kid. But once that money starts flowing to charter schools, that's when they really start to rise up and object to the growth of charter schools in North Carolina, which are growing substantially and continue to grow. Right now, we have about 184 charter schools in North Carolina. We might exceed 200 come the fall, which would be a remarkable change considering that we were capped at 100 schools just a few years ago.
And Terry, we should let our listeners know that, in fact, you are one of the founders of a new public charter school located in Wake County that's going to be opening up. A lot of people will mistakenly believe, Terry, about public charter schools that somehow you're able to pick and choose the best and the brightest, or the cream of the crop, as some people say, as the student population for a charter school. That's really not the case.
Absolutely not. We have a waiting list at our charter school, and we have to randomly choose who gets the seats when they open up. And so there's no opportunity for us to look at a student, look at their demographics, and say we want this student, not that student. We have to randomly choose the students that get the open seats at our school, and it's like that at every charter school.
Dr. Terry Stoops writes every day about the issue of education in North Carolina. Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the show this week. Thanks for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.